And welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. When you think Miami, then food, what comes to mind? Well, today we'll get a look at the history of the cuisine of Miami. Joining us now for Food and Dining is chef, author, and syndicated columnist, Linda Gassenheimer. Good afternoon, Linda.
Hello, Bonnie. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, likewise.
And Joe will be back next week.
Yes, he'll be back Monday.
Well-deserved vacation.
Exactly.
Right. Well, you know, Bonnie, Miami might be young. We consider it a young city, but we certainly have a fascinating history. From the Tequesta Indians to Cortaditas, stone crabs, empanadas. Well, our guest, Mandy Baca, gives us a culinary and cultural history of Miami in her book. It's called The Sizzling History of Miami Cuisine. Let's welcome Mandy Baca.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
So happy to be here.
Great to have you with us. And we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any food memories of early South Florida cuisine? We'd love to hear about it. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. I'm not sure. We don't have email today?
We do.
We do? Okay.
We do. Radio at WLRN.org, or you can even tweet us at Topical Currents.
Okay. Also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine suggestions from my Dinner Minutes column that's in today's Miami Herald, and also his wine column is in the Herald. Fred, any wine history here?
Oh, we have a wine history, we have a beer history, and we have a liquor history, and it's pretty wild.
Yeah, I'm almost afraid to ask about it. Well, let's go to Mandy Baca. Your fascination with food culture led you to the University of Gastronomic Science in Italy?
Yes.
So how did that bring you back to Miami?
Well, I am a Miami native. I decided to leave, like many people do, to explore. But I needed to come back because there's so much rich history here and nobody has really tapped into the food history part of it.
Did you learn about historical food at the in Italy, or was there anything there connected with your love of history?
The program was interdisciplinary, so we did study a lot of history, but it was all Italian food history, and that sparked the idea for Miami food history.
Oh, and I bet you ate well there too.
Yes, it's delicious.
Couldn't be bad. Well, I like the title of your book, Sizzling, Miami Cuisine. So what did you mean by that?
Well, food sizzles, so that's a given. But, you know, when you think of Miami, you think of the heat and the sun and the surf and the sand. That's sizzling, too. I mean, and we're all in Miami, and it's hot, and everyone's sexy. So got a little tongue-in-cheek play on the words.
Okay, I thought you meant sizzling because it's quite a checkered history here.
That as well. That's true.
Okay. So your book is divided by decades. It goes from the 20s, the 40s, 50s through the 70s. Did you see any food trends throughout that area? Throughout the history, actually.
Certainly. And that's why this book is so interesting. People forget, because Miami is all about fun, people forget that it is full of history, and the history is what has impacted us so much. In the 20s, people came because of the land boom, and people came because they wanted to build up this brand new city. I mean, it was a swamp, and now it's a metropolitan area full of buildings, and it's lively now. But back then, it was just a swamp, and people came to make money off of that. And they came from all over the country, from New York, from California. And so there was a big influence there that did influence our eating habits. Then in the 20s, in the 1920s and the 30s, a large Jewish population moved in, and that brought in their own wave of food. In the 40s and 50s, the vets from the World War II came in, and they brought...
Yeah, because Miami was a staging place for the army and all, so there were a lot of people here because of the war.
Correct.
Both wars, actually. Both World Wars.
Correct. What kind of foods came in with the vets?
Well, Americanized versions of Chinese, Italian, all that, German food, because they enjoyed it so much abroad, they wanted it here. So they Americanized that version of it. And then, of course, in the 60s, the Cubans came, and that sort of opened the floodgates for the 70s and the 80s, where the rest of Central and South America came, and the Haitians as well.
So a total mix-mash of all kinds of foods. Now, you've brought something for us to taste. Why? Bonnie's digging in. She's
course.
Always the first one to dig in. Here she goes.
Well, when it's something like this,
So tell us what you brought and why did you select this particular food from a historical point of view?
And so inside my book, there's a lot of recipes. I try to pick from different influences. And this one particularly is Steve Raiklin's mango salsa. And I just loved it because, you know, it's fresh and it's great for the...
So Bonnie's got a mouthful.
We're in the middle of August. You hear that? I mean,
how can you tell?
Are you sharing?
I'm sharing.
It's great to pair it with just some light pita chips, and it's a great lunch, and it's great for, I mean, we're in the middle of August, and it's very hot, so...
Well, now, you have big cubes of mango, and then there's cucumber in it, but the cucumber is almost pickled. So what are the flavors that I'm tasting? Because they're really, really good.
Correct. Well, I've let it sit and marinate overnight, and it has a little bit of lime juice, mint, and ginger. And so that lime juice and also some sugar have made the pickle almost, the cucumber into a pickle.
And the mint is really powerful.
Right.
And there's probably not a lot in there, is
there?
No,
there's not.
Yeah. Mm.
So
it's excellent.
So that's part of our history in the sense that mangoes are here. We grow a lot of row crops, the cucumbers, and so it's really, I suspect that this is a food that's been through the whole of history of Miami.
Correct.
From that point of view. Well, our number is 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And, you know, I posted on Facebook and Twitter and all that, what were your memories? We'd love to hear about your memories of Miami. And one person wrote in and said she was talking about the pub on Coral Way.
Yes.
What was that?
The pub on Coral Way. It was an icon in the 50s, along with the Pizza Palace and Orange Julius. People would go there for their... It was considered a special occasion place. And people... It was just an icon and people loved it.
Right, and another person wrote in that she loved the studio, and she said she just loved it because they went through their celebrations. Their whole family would go. When she was 15, that was a special thing to do, and on, weddings, anniversaries.
I remember the studio.
Do you remember
yes,
it?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, do you remember where it was?
I think it was in Coral Gables, wasn't it?
It could have been,
I was so young that...
We knew, 2 years old.
Yeah, at least. No. A little less than that.
Oh, I
see.
2 months. Okay. Now, what were some of Miami's most interesting food characters? There must have been a lot of them.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Miami's full of characters. There's the obvious ones, Norman Van Aken and Alan Saucer, but even before that.
I'm not sure that they are still here today.
Yes.
It's okay for us to call them characters.
I don't think they'd mind.
Okay.
In the beginning eras of Miami in 1910s and 1920s, there was definitely Jerry Galatis, who was the Greek immigrant that brought us Seven Seas Restaurant. And, you know, everybody came from all over the country to just come to this restaurant. Fresh fish. In the heart of downtown, you would go there before a theater show. Amelia Earhart even went once and dined there. And then there's John Siebold, who his name is still on our buildings in downtown, and he was a German immigrant that brought
now
us.
What was something about his past? Something happened to him he had to give up he had a restaurant there or something, and he had to give it up?
Here in downtown?
Yes.
Correct? Well, he did start as a baker, and there was a lot of anti-Semitic thoughts in that time, so people would
so he didn't do well because there was an anti-Semitic
well.
Problem mm-hmm. about it.
Correct.
But his name is still on the building.
Correct.
So it's a very nice place to go for jewelry at the moment.
Yes.
Right. I found that it was very, really fascinating. About Miami Beach, of course, was filled with swamp rats and mangoes and all. And the first hotel there was Brown's. And it's still there today. In fact, it's on the spot where Prime 112, the celebrity restaurant, is.
When did Joe's Stone Crab open?
That was 1912, I think it was.
1912, mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah.
You know, speaking of Miami Beach, I always liked all the Jewish delis over there. They serve some really authentic food.
And sadly, I think most of them are gone.
Remember Wolfie's?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Wolfie's and...
Yeah.
And somebody else wrote in on Facebook and said that she remembers Sam and Carl's was a Jewish deli in South Miami, which is also gone. So I think now we need to take a break.
We do.
Okay. Well, we're taking a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about the history of Miami cuisine with Mandy Baca. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Mandy Baca about her book, The Sizzling History of Miami Cuisine, Cortaditos, Stone Crabs, and Empanadas. It's a fascinating look at the cuisine and the culture of Miami. So if you're going to be having dinner tonight, we're doing dinner in minutes. And it's a shrimp and peach pasta salad. Now, if you've been in the market lately, these peaches are beautiful. They're ripe right now.
Yes.
So here's a new way to use them rather than just standing over the kitchen sink and letting it juice drip
dripping
down. Right. They add a contrasting sort of sweet flavor to the tangy dressing. So if you buy cooked shrimp, the only thing you'll have to heat up in your kitchen is to boil water for pasta, which is really simple.
And even Joe can do that.
Yes.
But we'll try it on him when he gets back. you boil the pasta, and I used a shortcut pasta, so any shortcut pasta will do. Mix some mayonnaise, a little warm water to thin it out a bit, horseradish and mustard together. Add some drained pasta to that, the cooked shrimp to that, and just toss it. And then I line a dinner plate with some lettuce or any kind of greens. Spoon the pasta and shrimp on that. Then I add some red bell pepper slices and my peach quarters. And if you want to make it look pretty, you can top it with some chopped chives. That's it. So easy. Couldn't be easier. The complete recipe is at my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com with a photo. And you can also read my eggplant parmesan recipe in today's Herald. And I picked that because eggplants are just beautiful. They're right in season now.
Oh.
So either peaches or eggplant, either way you go, you'll have really good food. And that's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, are we drinking historically?
Oh, absolutely. As I'm sure you know, Miami has always been kind of the wild, wild west for wine, beer, and liquor. Although, interestingly, it started out sober. Even before the city was incorporated in 1896, the pioneer Julia Tuttle pushed through deed restrictions banning alcohol anywhere in the city. And, of course, the result was that enterprising businessmen set up dozens of saloons 20 feet outside the city in North Miami.
Why did she do that, Fred?
Well, there was a strong temperance movement in those days, and she was part of that. So they were trying to reform the Americans and make us better people. Didn't work. In fact, for the next 20 years, the Women's Christian Temperance Union continued passing new laws banning booze, and understaffed and probably uninterested Miami police continued not enforcing them.
Well, Fred, to that point, you know, Mandy in her book was writing about when the Biltmore opened in 1926. At the opening, they were serving drinks during Prohibition.
Well, police would never raid a place, you know, a prominent place like that. They'd just go after the little guy if they went after anybody at all, which for the most part they didn't.
Okay.
In fact, when Prohibition was there from 1920 to 1930.
Hello, did we lose Fred?
These rum runners.
Oh, Fred, sorry.
Hello,
Fred. Fred, we lost you for a little bit. Prohibition came from 1920 to 1933, and then we lost you.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Sorry about that.
Well, so are we.
Well, yeah, Miami exploded in an orgy of illegal speakeasies and rum runners bringing in hooch from the Bahamas and hoodlums and boats actually speeding up the Miami River, machine gunning the hotels on Flagler Street.
They machine gunned the hotels?
Yeah, that was a wild and woolly era. That was worse than the cocaine cowboy era in a lot of ways.
Okay.
My.
But the moment Prohibition ended, there was a Miami Beach blacksmith named Dino Phillips who turned his old forge into a restaurant called, cleverly, The Forge. And over time, it became a watering hole for the likes of Frank Sinatra and Judy Garland and such. And later on, under Alvin and Sharif Malnick, it built up one of the top wine cellars in the world, always awarded every year by Wine Spectator magazine, with many thousands of bottles in its eight-room cellar, including a bottle I saw one time. Wasn't able to touch, but I saw it. It was a 1822 Chateau Lafite Rothschild that was supposed to be worth $150,000, even though at that age, there's no way it could be drinkable anymore. But Miami really arrived on the world wine map with the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, which started in 1997 at Florida International University. And it's now grown to be one of the biggest wine festivals in the world. I think there were like 60,000 people came to town for that last February, and all the top wineries. The festival was too much for one tourist from Maryland who wrote in a blog, "Paying hundreds of dollars for a few hours' access to an insane amount of booze seems silly. But watching women in fancy dresses with low cleavage and heels falling all over the sandy beach trying to hold wine glasses was amusing." But anyway, 60,000 people can't be wrong, so obviously a whole lot of people loved it. And Florida, with Miami in the lead, has become the second biggest wine market in the country.
Wow, that's amazing. Fantastic.
Well, so under second next to
California.
Of course.
Of course. Let's go to Gloria. She's been waiting.
But ahead of New York.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm surprised about that.
Gloria, hello, Gloria. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Gloria, you're on the air.
Hi there. What a wonderful show.
Thank you.
I'm a native Miamian, and my parents went to the opening of the Biltmore, and they went to the reopening at Hialeah. We moved to the beach in 1929, and one of my memories before World War II was the Russian Bear on Lincoln Road, and I can still remember the one and only time I had the most delicious cold borscht, and of course it disappeared with the war.
That was a Russian restaurant in Miami?
It was called the Russian Bear, and it was on Lincoln Road.
Interesting.
Yes. It was extremely popular.
Oh, I never heard of it either.
Mm-hmm. You know shortly, about it? Yes. Shortly after the World War II ended, the veterans brought that influence here, and someone opened a restaurant.
In the 40s?
Correct.
In the late 40s. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Gloria.
Well, I thank you for a wonderful show and lots of wonderful memories.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, another restaurant that's still here that's been here for over 100 years. Can you guess what it is?
Let me guess.
It's all right, I'll tell you.
Okay, tell me.
Tobacco Road.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
I was thinking more. I wasn't even thinking in that line. I was thinking.
No, exactly. I could tell from your face. Anyway, it's a checkered history there. Tell us about that,
correct,
Mandy.
It's scandalous. It opened as a bar, and then Prohibition came around, and they had to change it around. So as a storefront, it was a bakery. But there was a speakeasy in the back, and there was a password that you had to use to get in. They stored all their liquor on the second floor, so no one would find out. And, of course, because it's on the river, it's easy access to receive the liquor.
The suspicious liquor.
And then shortly after, it donned a lot of aliases. It was Chanticleer Restaurant at one point, and then it was the Chicken Roost at another point. In the 40s, it was a gay bar, and it wasn't very popular for a lot of people because they didn't want that around in Miami. And then finally, in the 1980s, it opened as Tobacco Road that we know it today.
And upstairs, the liquor isn't there. Anyway, not in boxes. They have jazz up there now.
Correct.
Yes. Is there an email?
Yes, Kathleen. Food Among the Flowers. She talks about faces in the Grove, The Mutiny and Suzanne's.
What was it in the Grove? It's called
Faces in the Grove. I didn't know. The Mutiny and Suzanne's.
Right,
we
yes.
remember.
Uh-huh.
Le Festival and the French Connection.
Right. The Festival was supposed to be such a wonderful French restaurant.
It was. Yeah. And then Marshall Majors and the infamous Neon Leon's. That's a tongue twister.
That one's interesting.
Neon Leon's?
That's a new one. I do not know that one.
All right, thank
you. That was in South Miami. That was a very colorful place. There was a shooting in the parking lot that kind of closed it down.
Oh, what about Fox's? Fox's has been there a long time, hasn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Fox's Sharon Inn.
Yes.
And it's been there since, the 1940s?
Correct.
And still busy as can be in South Miami.
And still great. I was there recently.
Yeah. And Little of Havana has become a very important segment of our city. But what was there before Little Havana was known as Little Havana?
Correct. Little Havana also has a great history. Right when the settlers first came in the 1890s, it was a Bahamian community. And then slowly as the land boom occurred in the 20s, more and more Jewish, more and more of the Jewish community came in, and they kind of took over. And so the Bahamian community...
So that was kind of figured like a suburb.
Correct, yes.
At that time.
That was actually the first suburb right outside of downtown Miami. So thereafter, in the 60s, when the Cubans came in, that's where they went, because it was right outside of downtown Miami, and it was cheaper, and it was just, they wanted to live in a suburb that was more accessible.
And you have to mention Versailles, which is the most Cuban few square feet in the world.
Correct.
We always take guests there when they come in, and you don't see that in Iowa or anything like that.
Of course, it's an icon, opened in the 70s.
And you say it's changing again now. The Cuban influence is kind of...
Tapering off. There's a large Central American and South American influence, but recently a lot of more artists are moving in to the area just because it's a lot cheaper.
So again, it's the price thing. They're leaving Wynwood and that area, and they're coming back into Little Havana. How
correct.
Interesting. Well, it's really been a very tasty week, an interesting week. Thank you, Mandy Baca, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Her book is The Sizzling History of Miami Cuisine, Cortaditos, Stone Crabs, and Empanadas, a fascinating book and look at Miami cuisine and culture. Fred, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie, you enjoyed that mango
salad. Yes, I did.
Salsa.
Thank you, Mandy, and thank you, Linda.
Well, next week we're going to be going back to school with directors of food and nutrition for Miami-Dade, Penny Parham, and Broward, Mary Mulder. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.